Welcome back to What Do You Know For Sure podcast with me, Anne Hughes. In this episode, I am joined by Bridget Russell for a wonderful conversation about love and about listening. We talk about bereavement and Bridget's loss of her husband last year and how that's impacted her life, and also really about how important love is, about how important listening is, and how it's actually really difficult for a lot of us to listen in an effective way. But the gift that we give people when we actually witness and hear and be present to what it is that they need to vocalise. This is a great conversation that I feel I even got a lot from in relation to my own bereavements, and to just thinking about how I listen to the people around me, to my children, to my husband, to my friends. And well, I listen a lot on this podcast. Do I listen quite so much in my life? So it's certainly given me a lot to think about. Bridget, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, it's lovely to be here, and it really is.
Thank you. Tell me a bit about you.
So I am Bridget Russell, and I live in Stirling, and I've lived in Stirling since 1999. So despite the English accent, I would say I love being in Scotland. It's my home. Mm-hmm. I've now lived here longer than the place I come from. So I come from Oxford and was born and brought up in Oxford. But I have real love and affinity for being here in Scotland. What else? I work for myself. So I'm a coach, and I work with people in leadership roles, all levels of organisations, but all in the public sector and third sector. I'm lucky enough to love what I do. And then I guess what I would say the sort of biggest thing about me just now is that last February, my husband of 17 years died of leukaemia. So Jim, my husband, who is the love of my life.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm sure it's been a really difficult time for you, Bridget. And so I suppose on the back of everything you've just told us, what do you know for sure?
I was thinking about this, Anne, and trying not to overthink it. What I know for sure is I know for sure how important love is. And I know, and by that I mean in all different sorts of ways. The love that I was lucky enough to have with Jim, which sustained me, challenged me, developed me, and vice versa. It was very much a partnership. So I know for sure that love really matters. And I know that always being open to learning and developing and listening to other people and learning from everywhere really matters.
Yeah, obviously it's been very challenging time, and how wonderful to know how important love is. You know, I think there's obviously great sadness in losing the people we love, but weren't we lucky to love them so much that it hurts so much, sort of, as always my reflection on that. Do you think that you're knowing that how important love is, you've always had it, or does it come on the other side of that bereavement or during that process because he was unwell?
I think I knew it all the time I was with him. Mm. So we met, I mean, relatively speaking, kind of late in life. So I was his fourth wife. that makes it sound a lot more scandalous than it was. But but I was in my late 30s and he was in his late 40 or 50. So we met each other later in life, I suppose. And I think we really knew who we were, and we just got on really, really well. So when I say I kind of knew what love or how important love is all the time I was with him. So yeah, and yes, I've really appreciated it since because it's not there. I mean, it's in me, but obviously he's not here. And it's a kind of, I guess it was a love which was a real equal partnership. So we did do very different things. He was a singer and songwriter, and I, you know, do my own, run my own business and do coaching and development. And what I always said to people was I felt really fortunate to live with and be with somebody who did something so different from me and did something so creative. Yeah. And so I think that the love was genuinely being curious and interested in what each other did and what each other thought. So what I really, really miss, I mean, I miss loads of things, obviously, about him. But what the heart of what I really miss is the conversations that we could have with each other about everything. And I think that the sort of heart, so the heart of that was love for each other and you know, love that's care, but also curiosity and interest and passion and care. You know, he really cared about what I do.
Yep. And you said there about how when you met, and you were both, I suppose, a bit later in life, and you said that you really knew yourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think there isn't, having done over 80 of this question on this podcast, have asked 150 radio guests on my radio show this question, there isn't a thing that everybody knows for sure, because I always wondered if there would be. I don't think there is. But what I do know is that essence, especially doing the podcast where it is only women, when I'm speaking to women that are in their 40s, in their 50s, older, they are telling me that they wish they had that awareness, that knowing of themselves, I feel, when they were younger, because imagine what they could have done with this in their 20s. So knowing yourself is such a journey that we should all be on, I think. Do you know when you began to know yourself, like really know yourself? Is that something you have an awareness of?
I don't know. I don't think I can look back and go, yes, in, uh-huh. You know, when I turned 37, suddenly I had the answer. I don't think so, Anne. And actually, I was just reflecting as you were saying that. I understand why people would say, oh, now I really understand myself. I wish I'd had this when I was in my 20s. I suppose I think, actually, I would rather see it as, I don't have any regrets. There's stuff I did and got wrong and, you know, got really, you know, agitated about when I was in my 20s. I think you have to go through that. And I think all of that is part of what makes me who I am now. So, but Jim and I, you know, bring it back to him and me, we did quite often say, we kind of laughed and said we probably met each other at the right time, if that doesn't sound strange. And don't know, you know, apart from the fact there was an age difference between us, but which, you know, doesn't bother me, but I think we were sort of at the right place respectively to meet each other. I don't know that I kind of reached a point and thought, yeah, now I've got the answer. Actually, I think what I also really learned alongside Jim was about never thinking, actually, I've got this cracked, and always, always learning. And I think I'm like that anyway, but I really, really got that from him. He had the most amazing capacity and interest in finding out stuff. I mean, even like I've said to people in the last week of his life, he was still, you know, we'd watch telly and we'd go, who's that actor or what's that? And we'd have to Google it. He always had to kind of know, you know, keep on finding stuff out and being interested. And so actually that thing of, you know, have I reached a point where I've got it cracked? No, don't think I ever will. But I think it's about being open to it.
Yeah, and it's about that journey, isn't it? And appreciating, I suppose, that you know yourself well just now, but you will, understanding, you'll know yourself better in a year's time too. It'll just get deeper and, And you talked about your relationship, which does sound like a beautiful relationship, and how you sustained each other, you developed each other, you challenged each other. And I suppose some people, that challenge thing, I think it's really important in a good, healthy relationship, but some people would find that challenging to be in a relationship where you challenge each other. What did that look like for you on the other side of a very loving relationship that now sadly came to an end? So you look back on your life now, what would you say was that key ingredient of that relationship?
Well, so for example, as I said, you know, we did very different things, and he never did the kind of work that I do, but I actually really, really valued being able to ask him about, you know, like I'd write something and I'd ask him to read it and give me an honest view about it. And sometimes that was challenging because he would, but challenging in a really good way, because he would call out the, you know, any management speak or jargon or yeah. stuff that, you know, I don't really understand what you're trying to say here. And, you know, sometimes that would be really, you know, sometimes that can be hard. I mean, I do a lot of writing and it can be hard if somebody critiques something you've written, especially if you've been kind of slaving over it. Mm-hmm. But I always, I suppose, what was important for me in that challenge and the other way around, because, you know, I'd challenge him about some things, is knowing, completely trusting that he had my best interests at heart and yeah. really cared about what I was doing. He also was really good, and this is the thing that I've really had to adjust to this year, and it's been hard living on my own, is not having somebody that, so what he used to be really good at doing, Anne, was listening. He listened. I mean, he was the best natural listener I've ever met, and he knew when to stop me and say, right, enough, you know. And that could sound, you know, if I just described it sort of, you know, very bluntly, that might sound like harsh, but actually the context would be he'd listened for a long time, mm-hmm. and then he'd say, enough, you know. And he knew when to spot me slipping into overthinking something, and that's because, you know, we knew each other so well, and that's the challenge this year, is I need to do that for myself, and sometimes I get that wrong.
Yeah, because overthinking is a battle we all fight, isn't it? And I know, because I've heard you speak, and that's how we're here today, that listening is massively important for what you do. So yeah. How did you get yourself to a place where you realised there's so much magic in listening? That's where the sweet spot is, if we just listen.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I've given one example there that, you know, having been married to somebody who was naturally a very good listener, and so that was part of it. Also, because I'm a coach, so listening is kind of what I do for a job, if you like. I mean, a lot of the heart of coaching is really listening. But this year in particular, I've been very involved in this thing called Spaces for Listening with a colleague, Charlie Jones. And what we do is we convene spaces, as the name would suggest, over Zoom, because it's been during the pandemic time, for eight people, including the two of us, to come together for just under an hour. And it's pretty structured, but it's in the form of three listening rounds. And coming back to your question, the reason for doing that was we both had a sense that we all need more space for listening to each other and being heard. And I really strongly feel that that's always been there. That need has always been there. I was going to say in organisations, but actually across society, frankly. But this year in particular, I think even more, because people are holding and dealing with so much stuff. And what I notice, Anne, is that it's almost like the more pressure people feel under, and the kind of more fear of uncertainty and the difficulties we're facing, the more there's a tendency to sort of organize things to within an inch of their lives, you know, to sort of pack a meeting full of items on the agenda, and there's no space to actually just say, you know, how are you? How are you doing? So I suppose that's what was behind it. But actually, what, you know, coming back to your question about what do I know about listening, if I put a personal slant on that, in the last year, in dealing with grief and, you know, losing Jim and living with grief, nobody can solve that for me. There isn't a fix. You know, he's not here, and I have to live with grief. And actually, the last thing I need is somebody to try and rescue me, because there is no rescue. What has been incredibly powerful, though, is being listened to, genuinely listened to, and very kindly listened to by different people, and being able to talk about whatever I need to talk about in that moment. And sometimes I don't need to talk about my grief, and sometimes I do.
Yeah.
And just knowing that someone will just listen without judgment, without interruption, and without trying to fix, is incredibly powerful. And that's been my experience. And then other people who've gone through Spaces for Listening with us, or then take, because actually our aim is that people take on the approach and use it in their own teams, organisations, networks, other people have reported the same, that they expect, I suppose people expect to get the power of really being listened to uninterrupted, but the bit that surprises a lot of people is how much they get from listening to other people, almost quietening their own minds and just listening. That's all they have to do. And actually we've got this sort of, you know, some people have said that phrase, you know, oh, just listening, who knew just listening could be so powerful? But just listening is a lot, you know, because if you think about it, we so many of us very rarely get sort of pure listening for a few minutes where someone isn't taking the conversation off in a different direction.
And it's very, my reflections on listening is I've always got a lot to say. And what I know about people that I interact with, some people very clearly listen so that they can hear, and some people listen waiting for a space so they can speak. And that is now, especially in doing this podcast for this year on Zoom and having all these conversations with all these women, most of whom I have never met, and I don't have prepared questions, so I really need to listen.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, does it fill my cup to actually listen to what you've got to say and not just be in my own head overthinking and listening to what I've got to say. And it's so, and I do try to say to people sometimes, remember to listen, not to speak, to listen, to hear. And do you think that we as a society have perhaps become so self-obsessed, for want of a better word, that we've forgotten to listen, to hear? Because that's what I sometimes feel.
Yes. I think, I mean, there's so much in that.
Uh-huh.
I think the sort of pace that we're all going at doesn't help. So, and yet, having said that, you know, people say, oh, you know, there isn't time to sort of stop and really listen to somebody. I'm really busy. And yet, actually, it doesn't take long. I mean, in Spaces for Listening, each of the listening rounds is 2 minutes. You know, 2 minutes of speaking and being listened to, and actually, well, 2 minutes times three because it's three rounds. But that's all it. That's all it is. But actually, that's a lot. So I think that the sort of pace and kind of almost, this, you know, also the number of distractions that we have and things we're trying to juggle. So I think those get in the way. I wonder also sometimes what gets in the way of people really listening. So again, if I think about, you know, say close friends or family to me might struggle to really listen to me if they think, they feel sorry for me, they, you know, they're worried about me, and so they want to jump in and make it all right. And yet actually just listening to whatever is on my mind, or actually the thing that I've said to a few people, the thing I find the most, I don't know what the word is, affirming, is to be able to talk about Jim.
Yeah.
You know, not to talk about his death, not to talk about my grief, but to talk about his life and our life together. And so I wonder whether what gets in the way of people really listening and kind of, as I say, quietening their own mind is a fear that I might need to do, you know, I might need to jump in and rescue this person or do something for them or make it better. And especially at the moment, and when people are, you know, if they're working alongside each other and they're aware that people are dealing with so much stuff, there's that kind of anxiety, I think, of, oh, I've got to kind of make it better for someone else.
Yeah.
And what's been so lovely and so powerful in Spaces for Listening is hearing so many people say, they have this realization during the rounds of listening to seven other people of how much they simply can offer, we can offer each other by listening for a bit longer. And maybe most people don't actually need somebody else to jump in with a solution. The solution, if you like, was being heard.
Yep. And I often say that, you know, about being a mother, about working with teams like I do a lot. So often there seems to be so much strife and so much hurt and so much anger. And actually everybody just wants to be heard, don't they?
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful gift, you know, listening to this, somebody listening to this, what a gift to give the people you love to just actually sit and listen without judgment, without opinion, without being solutions focused, because sometimes people don't want a solution, don't they not?
Yeah.
They just actually, they don't. They just need to speak.
Exactly. And I think, something that I think I certainly wasn't able to do this when I was younger. I think this has definitely developed with age, is about really retaining curiosity. And again, it's another thing that I really kind of learned more about alongside Jim, about really being curious about somebody and noticing, you know, when you, because actually going back to your thing about why do people listen to jump in rather than listen to hear, I wonder if sometimes we're a bit scared of what somebody might say, and what if we disagree with it, and what if that takes us into conflict. I think that's another big thing that you know is very, very present at the moment. And I guess over the last few years, certainly the last year, I've become a lot more comfortable with that actually if you listen for longer and really listen and stay curious about what someone is saying, in the vast majority of cases we are very rarely diametrically opposed about something. We might have some points of difference, but actually, and that's another thing that people say in Spaces for Listening, is how amazing it is how there are so many more points of commonality than there are difference. And one thing we don't do in Spaces for Listening is any introductions. We just go straight into the listening, so people don't know, you know, what roles they have, where they come from, what organization they work for. And it's so, that might sound odd, but actually it's really liberating, because then it enables us to meet as a group of eight human beings. Yeah. And I do think quite a lot, Anne, about how amazing would that be if we could do that more often in our communities across society, is actually really meet each other. And it's not that where we come from and our backgrounds and our roles don't matter, but actually, can we listen to each other first and kind of and hear a bit more about what's going on before we jump in and judge? And especially because so much just now gets so polarized.
Yeah. And as I was saying to you at the start, part of my reason for starting this podcast was because I worried that women had lost that informal interactions that we have all the time in our lives, and therefore I did this so a woman could sit and have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and listen to this and feel as if it was a social interaction, and by listening to someone else speaking their truth, that they would in their life in some way be able to speak their truth. But as you're speaking about how people react to you talking about grief, for example, do you think there's something in it about if I witness you live your grief on display, on show, on reel, does that hold a mirror to me and say, right, Anne, deal with your grief, and am I ready to deal with my grief? Do you think that's what it's about as well?
Actually, just what you remind me is, so one thing that, because I do talk about my grief quite a lot, and I tweet quite a lot about grief, I've been doing that this year, not before this year. But one thing that worries me is I wouldn't ever want anyone to think that I then think, well, that makes me some kind of expert. I'm not. I'm just, all I'm sharing is my experience of it. This is how it's impacting me. This is how I'm trying to cope with it. And that's felt really important this year, to be open and honest about it, but not because I'm trying to say to anyone else, and this is how you should do it, at all. It's just this is me, this is how I'm dealing with it. And I suppose what I notice is how, well, I wonder, especially in organizations, we have become so scared of, perhaps for good reasons, of leaving space where that's not kind of really shaped and controlled. So people have said to me, what happens in a space for listening if somebody cries or gets upset? And I think, well, you know, actually we're adults and we're choosing to go into this space, into this conversation. And actually we can each, you know, we've all got more resources to look after ourselves than perhaps we sometimes give each other credit for. So if I'm in a conversation or it's space for listening and I get upset about, you know, because I think about Jim or I think about my grief, you know, that didn't just suddenly happen in that conversation. It's there all the time. And actually the, you know, the kindest thing someone can do is listen and be there. Or to leave me alone if that's what I need.
And you know, and I think to remind ourselves that it's natural to cry when you are grief stricken. So let's not make that unnatural, because that's actually really bad. Because I love the way you're saying that you deal with your grief, and it's not to say you're unique, but it's just to say I'm dealing with it. And I think, you know, I lost my mum also to leukemia when I was 13, and I didn't deal with my grief until so much later. And you know, it was a tough time, obviously, for my dad and my siblings and for the whole family. So there is no criticism of that, but there is something about how do you need to deal. And my husband, when I was unwell 4 years ago and my life lay in the balance for 9 days there, My husband was very, you know, was having conversations with my sisters about we need to make sure the kids deal with their grief, because he knew instinctively that I hadn't dealt with mine when I was a child. So he was already, before I had even, and I didn't die, thankfully, but, you know, before. So I think it's so important that we actually provide space for each other to say it's okay to just deal with your stuff, because see, when you bury it, that's when your life, quite frankly, goes to shit, isn't it?
Yes. And I mean, in being able to deal with it, a big part of that was the way that Jim approached his illness and his own death. He and his family have, and me have talked about that a lot, where that came from for him, sort of the most incredible wisdom and calm. And then that really helped me. So we talked about it. You know, he knew he got the terminal diagnosis just before Christmas 2019, and then died on the 6th of February. And we talked about it a lot over Christmas and January. And I still think that was incredible, actually. But it really helped me, and it helped all his family as well. And then I guess I've continued that. So I'm not sort of talking about it all of the time and kind of I hope and kind of pushing it at everybody, but it's especially because of the kind of work I do, and it felt really important, like how can I be talking about the importance of listening and authenticity and integrity and being open and humble and all of this in terms of leadership, and then as a coach and a facilitator not mention this huge thing that has happened to me. That would have felt really insincere and not in keeping, and yet I'm really sure I needed to find my own way to do that. So I do, you know, I read some of the stuff, but I'm kind of selective about, you know, and I'm kind of averse to sort of big long lists that tell me what stage am I at. Actually, it's kind of whatever it's, you know, one thing I've learned is it's certainly not linear.
Yeah.
It kind of,
Undoubtedly you must, I'm sure, have empowered other people to actually sit and contemplate their grief or other stuff that is going on in their life. So that's a job well done, I would think, Bridgette.
Thank you. I hope so.
Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been lovely to meet you and talk to you.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this episode of What Do You Know For Sure podcast. If you would like to connect with me, you can do that across social media by searching Anne Hughes Ignite. If I refer to my radio show and the podcast, you can catch those on my Mixcloud. Again, just searching Anne Hughes Ignite. And if you or anybody you know want to answer this question with me, please do get in touch. Just go onto my website, annehughesignite.co.uk, and fill in the contact page at the bottom, and I'll be delighted to have this conversation with you too. Thank you.